This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, Director of Distance Learning at Wyoming Catholic College. Not only am I the host of the After Dinner Scholar, but I'm the director of Wyoming Catholic College's Adult Week, the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought. We've been optimistically hoping to hold the school in June as scheduled, but that has become unworkable for two reasons. First, there's the question of reopening the world over the next few months. And second, our faculty have been putting heroic efforts into teaching our residential students while they're not in residence. Preparing for the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought in June is just not possible. Thus, there is still time to sign up for the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, which will now be held here in Lander from Sunday, August 9th to Friday, August 14th. The topic is the same: beauty is truth, science, and the Catholic imagination. See our website, wyomingcatholic.edu, for more details. Now on to this week's After Dinner Scholar podcast. You can kill people with sound, noted Estonian composer Arvo Pärt. Then he went on, and if you can kill, then maybe there is also the sound that is opposite of killing. And the distance between these two points is very big. You are free. You can choose. This is perhaps an apt commentary on 20th century classical music. In this lecture to Wyoming Catholic College juniors, Dr. Stanley Grove discusses the musical works of Pärt, as well as John Cage and Krzysztof Penderecki. Sounds that kill, sounds that bring life, and in the case of John Cage's 4 minutes and 33 seconds, no sound at all.
Greetings, junior music students in diaspora, in quarantine, in anxious expectation of what awaits. Christ is risen. Let our souls be filled with the music of triumph and rejoicing. Having said which, and with the encouragement that you should be seeking out beautiful music to uplift the heart and fortify the will, I must say that the period of music we have lately plunged into in this mid-20th century part of our curriculum often seems to present us with anything but spiritual uplift or even beauty. Professor Hodgkinson offered, for your sampling, a wide array of representative music, and while I trust that you've explored it in some depth already, I wanted to further prompt your reflections on the music with a few reflections of my own. Some of this stuff I had not listened to in a long while, or even ever, and I must say that it provokes some strong reactions in myself, as well as doubtless in many of you. One theme I'd like to sound at the outset is that of caution. Let not our previous acquaintance with pre-classical, classical, and romantic beauty in music too hastily lead us to reject or despise the avant-garde explorations of the early and mid-20th century. For one thing, the music is saying something about the culture in which it is embedded, a culture which received it, sometimes enthusiastically. For another, perhaps we can learn to see beauty and thus an authentic expression of inner reality in places where we didn't necessarily expect to. In other words, intelligent or meaningful listening can require a certain educating of the ear. Finally, music's first task, like that of other fine arts, is to speak in a beautiful and thus meaningful way, but not always to express the beautiful as such. It's the same as with literature. Great writing will speak to the heart in beautiful and therefore effective and effective ways, but by no means always of beautiful things. Indeed, evil, dark, ugly, or simply inane things must occasionally be addressed in the arts by way of emphasizing the good and true and beautiful. Comedy has a role to play, and comedy, says Aristotle, is a species of the ugly. Of course, as we have often said before, it may be difficult, requiring much prudence on our part, to know just where composers and listeners alike should draw the line between appropriate and inappropriate. And there's clearly a subjective as well as an objective dimension here. Before turning to a few particular works, a quick reminder of what we had encountered so far in recent weeks. Speaking generally, we saw in Wagner a systematic suspension of tonal resolution, verging on tonal ambiguity. Moving forward, the music of Debussy and then the atonalists, tonal ambiguity becomes outright atonality, whether by a sort of indifference or by deliberate design. And there were similar assaults on the rhythmic side of music, departures from what had hitherto been regarded as normal in any sense. One thinks of the polyrhythms of Stravinsky, but we'll go well beyond polyrhythms to an absence of any recognizable rhythm in some works. But let me turn then to a few of the pieces that were placed before us last week. First, I want to say a word about John Cage, or rather his work, 4 minutes, 33 seconds. This little novelty has been hyped to the point of absurdity ever since it first appeared, or shall we say, did not appear, in 1952. I think we don't need to give it much attention, though you might want to be able to say that you sat through at least one complete performance, quote unquote. There are several of these on YouTube. Is this a legitimate commentary on music? Is it a commentary on anything at all? Certainly, it is not music. There's no need for us to pretend that. But at best, it falls under some other species of performance art. The composer's intentions, one notes with amusement, call for any instrument or combination of instruments. Well, turning to a work which at least includes sound rather than the ambient silence, or at best, the nervous coughing of people in an otherwise quiet auditorium, we have Krzysztof Penderecki's Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima, 1960. This work was so named and dedicated only after he had completed it. Originally, it had the title 8 minutes, 37 seconds. Does that sound familiar? Leading one to doubt that it has any programmatic function. Certainly, however, the emotion or exhaustion of emotion that it conveys is appropriate to this most barbaric act ever inflicted by man upon man. Yet the work seems to possess no narrative, offers no vicarious possibility of reliving its namesake horror in a meaningful way. It offers no catharsis. Time itself all but ceases, and with it, hope itself. Only misery and pain remain. I understand that some of this music has been used in such recent movies as The Exorcist, The Shining, Children of Men, dark and dystopian films all, none of which, however, have I seen. I simply know them by reputation. Penderecki's work focuses on modifications of sound to the almost complete disregard of recognizable pitch and interval, surely a depiction of hell, or the hellish. I think if you listen to the first 2 minutes or so and then cut to near the end, which perhaps around 9 minutes, 30 seconds in the YouTube version posted by Gerubach, Gerubach, then you will have heard enough to get the sense of it and perhaps never want to hear it again. Or if you do, you might ask yourself carefully, just why? Cui bono? At the very least, let it be an occasion of offering prayer for the victims and the perpetrators of the atrocity which it memorializes. Penderecki, by the way, died just 3 weeks ago, March 29th, during this period of the COVID-19 quarantine, although he died of a pre-existing illness. Turning then to the work I want to spend more time on than any other in this talk, Arvo Pärt's Credo. Please watch the version on YouTube that goes under the title, quote, 3P Pärt Credo 1968 entire with subtitles, unquote. Ungainly title, but if you are following that particular version, which is the one Professor Hodgkinson posted with his lecture last week, you can follow the subtitles in English. You can note my time tags, which I'll be referring in the next couple of minutes, and will also benefit by rather effective camera work. So, pure elemental Bach is Arvo Pärt's foundation in this work for his assertion of the faith that transforms the world, Credo in Jesum Christum. Until, at 2 minutes 18 seconds, this gospel faith begins to be challenged by the world's message of revenge and vindictiveness, a message that soon enough reveals itself as demonic hatred, with the sinister snakes rattling in the strings at 2 minutes 41 seconds, and then a progressive disintegration and descent into hell, which is shatteringly complete by 6 minutes 43 seconds. I know of nothing more terrifying in music. The triumph of Christ over evil, a triumph that can come only by yielding to injury and letting the divine work within us, begins to be evidenced by 7 minutes 53 seconds, though not without recurring hints of the terrible conflict. But it is that divine healing, unstoppable. I find utterly masterful the piano's traversing of the octaves beginning at 11 minutes 37 seconds, vanquishing hell's cacophony by the simplest of all intervals. This is about as cathartic as music gets. It does what music should do, but by availing itself of the most extreme means. For this reason, I would call it dangerous music, not to be listened to casually, not to the point of becoming inured to its intensity, certainly not very often, and never by children. It's rather like witnessing an exorcism. Now, the communist atheist government of Estonia banned it for its obviously Christian message, and that government would last another generation. And now it's gone. But the music and, of course, the life-saving gospel remains. Finally, as an example of the same Arvo Pärt's newfound tintinnabuli style, we have the little jewel he called For Alina, a piano piece. Not long after composing the Credo, Pärt went silent. He experienced a religious and musical conversion, reemerging in the late 1970s as a man and a composer transformed. In the minimalist style that would characterize the rest of his career, he's currently in his 85th year, by the way, and as far as I know, still composing. There will be essentially two voices, a melodic voice that hews closely to the diatonic scale, and an accompanying voice that ranges even more strictly within the associated tonic triad. For Parrott, these voices have all-pervasive religious significance. The M voice, as it is sometimes called, represents the human world of variability and even error, while the T voice, the triadic voice, stands for divine constancy and forgiveness. In this piano miniature for Alina, the number of notes per measure increases and then decreases symmetrically from beginning to end. The only point at which the T voice departs from the B minor triad is when it drops to a C sharp in bar 11. We're still within the prevailing key, but it has an almost magical effect. This is at 1 minute 52 seconds in the version we asked you to listen to last week. At this point in the original manuscript, the composer had drawn a little flower. The piece itself, deceptively simple, is not easy to play. I think it would be well not to attempt to play it until one's piano technique is very secure indeed. With this and many other pieces of like inspiration, the Parrott of the last 45 years, he who exhibited in his youth the influence of Stravinsky and Schoenberg, has opened up to an appreciative world, a whole other world of transcendence and of hope. His music, I dare say, will be listened to centuries from now, if there remains a world to do the listening.
All the works Dr. Grove discussed are available at YouTube, but particularly if you have never listened to his compositions, let me recommend Arvopeth's Credo as something of a treat for this Easter season. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.